How about you just state your name and tell us what you do for Mozilla?
Okay, my name is Jervis Markham, known mostly as Jerv, and at the moment I work part-time for the Mozilla Foundation.
And what capacity?
There's three of us in the foundation part, which is the sort of the parent of the corporation, and so we have a sort of a slightly different role to them. And although Frank Hecker, who's the guy in charge, he's I guess director of policy. Zach and I, who are the two other people, don't really have formally defined roles or job titles. We kind of just do whatever needs doing. I guess I can tell you a bit about my areas of responsibility if that would help.
Sure. Yeah. Great.
I've been working on licensing, both trademark and code. I've been working on some sort of security stuff, UI and certificates, a bit of anti-phishing thinking and work on that. And general, also, the foundation is at the moment trying to develop its strategy in terms of how exactly we're going to distribute some of the proceeds of our success to the community, both the Mozilla community and the wider community. And Frank and Zach and I are all working on that together.
Great. How'd you kind of come to be involved with Mozilla?
Back in, I guess it was, well, I started off at university, at Oxford University in the UK in 1997, and I was doing chemistry. And for the first year that was kind of okay, and for the second year it got rapidly worse. So by the summer of 99, which was the end of my second year, I wasn't really enjoying it very much at all. And I sort of always knew I wanted to be a software engineer. I didn't quite know why. I ended up doing chemistry at university. Well, I guess I enjoyed it at school. I'm trying not to make this too long. But basically what happened was I ended up changing courses. It was all very sudden. I'd arrived for the third year and I was well behind, and it was all very miserable, and I was talking to my tutors and saying, what can I do? And they were presenting some not very helpful suggestions. And I was on the point of leaving, applying for jobs, but within a week, God just opened all the doors and changed everything, and I was on a different course doing a different thing. I moved straight into the second year of the three-year computation course, which is quite unusual. And I did that instead. So having like spent my first term catching up a lot with the stuff that I'd missed from the first year, I sort of decided at the start of 2000 that it would be really good to get involved in a free software project. And I read a comment on Slashdot from a guy. I've tried to find it since. I think it was a guy called Matthew Thomas, who was heavily involved with UI in those days. The project's much less involved now. I think he now works for Ubuntu, the Linux distribution, lives in Brazil. He was in New Zealand then. He was saying, you know, the Mozilla project could do some help. So I went along to the site and looked around, and they had a thing called the Bugathon, which was a test case thing where, you know, if there was a rendering problem, you got it down to a minimal test case and uploaded that, and you could get points for doing numbers of test cases, and they'd send you, like, T-shirts and stuff like that. And I thought that was kind of cool and fun. It's something I knew that I could do, and so I did a few of those. And I kind of ended up doing this daily testing of the builds, what's called smoke testing. You know, you fire it up, see if smoke comes out. And kind of ended up with sort of some responsibility for making that happen every day, and sort of coordinating volunteers and finding people to do that. And it all kind of moved from there. I mean, Asa Dotzler, have you talked to him?
We're hoping to this afternoon.
He and I kind of got involved around the same time, around the same sort of way. There was a lady called, a guy called Eli Goldberg, who I'm having dinner with on Friday, actually. He now works for Flock, who are doing stuff with the Mozilla codebase, and a lady called Christine Bagel were two Netscape QA people who were very, you know, very keen on getting community involvement, and they'd written documents and stuff, and sort of working with them and with Acer at that time. That's really how I got involved. Things sort of took off so that at the end, when I graduated at the end of 2001, sort of summer 2001, I spent 3.5 months here working for Netscape, but as an intern with Mozilla.org, which was the virtual organization that ran the project at that time, which is a division of Netscape. And so several people before had internships with Netscape working for Netscape, but I was the first person to work for Mozilla.org. And it was at that time that I became a member of the Mozilla.org staff, the organizing group, sort of more by, it didn't, it kind of happened by accident, really. It kind of happened sort of before I kind of noticed it happening, and then they kind of grandfathered me in when they realised, but which was very kind of them, but you know, I try and help out. So I got involved with that then, and ever since then, you know, back in the UK, where I, up until last July anyway, I had a full-time job in software at a company in North London. I've been doing staff stuff and trying to help keep the project moving in the right direction. Obviously, things have changed a bit since then. We've had the foundation, and then the foundation and the corporation. And last July, I was offered a job, but we kind of negotiated this thing. I now work 2 days a week for the foundation, and 2.5 days a week, half time, for the company I have been working for since I graduated. And the other half a day a week, I'm unemployed, which is great because I get more holiday.
Could you maybe briefly just sort of describe the relationship of the foundation to the corporation?
Okay, so what happened back in 2003, it was kind of clear that Netscape had been bought by AOL, and then AOL had merged with Time Warner, and for their own internal business reasons, which they've since reversed, they were getting out of the browser business, and people, you know, didn't want the Mozilla project to die, and so basically the Mozilla Foundation was the lifeboat. As sort of the Netscape ship went down, what happened was that AOL were persuaded to give $2 million in seed funding. You know, the rights changed, the license, the trademarks, the machines that were running all the services, and they handed it all over. And sort of like five people ended up in an office in at one end of downtown Mountain View, going, okay, like, we've got $2 million, so that gives us about X months to figure out how to make some money. What do we do now? And that was what Firefox and Thunderbird were just starting. They were kind of a reaction to Netscape's control of the UI, and to the fact that the suite was monolithic and wasn't really, you know, it was too complicated for people. They wanted to do something simpler and more stripped down, and there'd been that desire for a while, but basically they decided to forge out and do that project, and so those were up and coming, and they decided, you know, to focus on those over time. And so the foundation was around for a little while, and Firefox really took off. And this created a problem. It was one of those good problems to have, where we had quite a bit of money coming in. Now, there's a rule about 501c3 nonprofits, which is that only up to a third of their income can come from, I don't know the exact legal situation or the exact words that's used, but basically it's like business income from commercial ventures. And so we were going to get into tax difficulties if we carried on just taking all of this money from our relationships and putting it into the foundation. And so we needed a way to pay tax, and as it turns out, forming a subsidiary corporation is the most convenient way to do that. And so all of the sort of day-to-day revenue-generating activities, the production of the key products, Firefox and Thunderbird, have moved into the corporation, whereas the foundation is responsible for sort of overall control of the project governance, you know, how decisions are made, but also looking after the things which are not corporation-focused, you know, things like Bugzilla, which is a bug-tracking system, Camino, which is a Mac browser specifically for the Mac, SeaMonkey, which is the continuation of the suite. The corporation decided no longer to continue the suite, but a bunch of contributors, actually mostly from Europe, felt that it was important, and so they've continued it under the name SeaMonkey, which was its original code name, and other projects like that.
How was the decision made to put certain activities into the corporation, keep others with the foundation?
Basically, the stuff that makes money goes into the corporation. I mean, that's the, you know, the stuff that was, you know, that was generating the revenue. It's very difficult because on the one hand, the Mozilla organization as a whole wants to support its contributors in anything that they choose to do. On the other hand, there's undeniably channel conflicts between Firefox and SeaMonkey and Camino. And so this has always caused a certain amount of tension. And putting, you know, basically when Firefox moved into the corporation, this was saying basically, look, in terms of browsers, Firefox is the thing. You know, we're going to provide resources in terms of infrastructure resources for these other things, and you guys want to do it, you're on your own, and, you know, but all of the effort of the, you know, this money is feeding back in and hiring contributors, and their effort is going to be focused on Firefox and Thunderbird to a lesser extent.
What kind of, if you could just elaborate on that a little bit, what kind of tensions are there between kind of the
the
well,
marquee products and the others.
Well, it's a promotion thing, isn't it? You know, I mean, you know, one viewpoint would say, okay, Mozilla.org has these three browsers, and so what we should do is on the front page we could go, okay, we've got three browsers, we've got Firefox, we've got the Suite, we've got Camino. You should choose the one that's best for you. On the other hand, another point of view says that consumers are not really set up to start making those choices. They don't want to have that handed to them. They want to be told, you know, this is the best thing for you, and for it to be the best thing for them, you know. And sort of splitting our resources into three projects, even if people were, you know, equally interested in promoting all three, probably isn't the best way. I think certainly that if we'd had some sort of equal opportunities policy, in a sense, towards all of the things that people wanted to do, then Firefox would not be the success it is today. Firefox is a success because we have a very single-minded focus on making it particularly a success, and we have a bunch of contributors who also have that focus, people like Spread Firefox and the community, and in fact, you know, it has really caught the public imagination. Whereas if the Mozilla story was not, hey, we have Firefox, isn't it cool? It was, hey, we have this wonderful choice of browsers, isn't choice great? I don't feel that there would be quite that thing there. So, yeah, I mean, and basically that leaves the guys from SeaMonkey and Camino in the situation that, you know, we're supporting them with infrastructure, but we're not doing any promotion, and they understand that. And I think, in a sense, there's a realization come to that, because most of the people who are working on SeaMonkey, for example, are like, well, we prefer a suite. We want it all integrated. We don't like the separate applications. And we're doing it for ourselves, right? And if other people download it, that's cool. Whereas, you know, and Camino is still, you know, we want a native Mac browser, we want something that integrates well with our operating system because we're Mac addicts, and, you know, that slightly strange thing that Mac people have. It's a little bit difficult. You know, I try and get them into therapy. They don't want to go. So, yeah, I mean, that's the tension. When they feel that, I think they've mostly made their peace with being second fiddle, but sometimes, you know, when they want to do a release and all of the build and release, because it's sometimes around infrastructure is where the tension is, because all of the build and release people are in the corporation, right? Whereas build and release is something that actually is needed for all the projects, you know, the infrastructure. And so if, you know, build and release are all tied up doing a Firefox release and the SeaMonkey release has to wait a month, that's kind of a little bit difficult. That this was one of the difficulties splitting the foundation and the corporation. Where do those people go? If you have two teams, you know, what do you do? And in the end, we decided we're going to put it all in the corporation, for better or for worse. But that does present some problems. But I mean, this is minor stuff, I think, in the grand scheme of things.
Do you see? I guess how would you characterize kind of the relationship of people who kind of work here to kind of the wider community of volunteers?
That's a tough one. The Mozilla project has been innovating in the sort of the free software project space in a bunch of different ways for a very long time. I mean, we were the first large free software project when Netscape freed the code. And so we've hit a lot of problems before other people. And also we've encountered a lot of problems that are a little bit our own. For example, because we had this corporate sponsor originally, this single one, we've always had I don't know how to put it. That always cast a shadow. You know, it was always, no matter how much we tried to gain our independence, and we did over time, it was quite a bit that, you know, Netscape was in charge of a number of things. And so there's always been, for the project, one central sort of nucleus of where the majority of contributors are. It's not like some of the other free software projects where it's pretty evenly spread, you know what I mean? And so I feel that we're in a constant fight to make sure that decisions are not just made by some guy looking over the cubicle wall and talking to some other guy, and they decide that, right, this is what we're going to do, and then they might or might not tell everyone else what the decision is. But that if the, you know, decisions are important and there are other people who have a stake, then they have an opportunity to have a say. And I guess that tension in some ways characterises the relationship between the corporation and the community. Because what would be best is if everyone was part of the community and it was all kind of like even. But because the corporation tends to hire the high quality contributors and because they're all in one place, in practice that doesn't necessarily happen. And you know, there are certain optimizations you can make. I mean, Mitchell has been saying that, you know, full openness is bad, and you know, sometimes you just need to make a decision, and that's true. But I think perhaps what characterises the relationship between the corporation and the community is, I don't want to say an imbalance, but a difference, certainly, which isn't necessarily harmful, but I mean, you can just treat it as a fact of life.
What kinds of like communication channels are open between the corporation, the foundation, and the community? How do you try to mitigate those challenges?
Well, see, I think thinking about it in terms of communication between the corporation and the community is already thinking about it the wrong way, because it kind of assumes these two blobs which have these defined channels. I mean, the project tries very hard to have communication channels which open such that the two guys in the cubicles next to each other are communicating via an open channel. We have the Bugzilla bug system where bugs are discussed. We have news groups which were sort of atrophying for a long time but have recently hopefully been revitalized. And I think to get in the corporation too, over the past few months there's been an increasing realization that we need more openness, and they've gone back to, in a sense, some of what we used to do before and have been surprised at the results. I mean, Mike Beltzner, who's the new UI guy, comes from IBM, right? And they're having these status meetings for Bon Echo, which is the code name for Firefox 2. And, you know, he was saying that, you know, people were saying about Bon Echo that we should have an open planning process, dial in, anyone can dial in, publish all the meeting notes on the wiki, completely open. And from IBM, I was like, wow, yeah, scary. But in fact, he was saying it's worked really well, and I'm never interrupted on the phone by someone who doesn't have a good point to make, and, you know, I feel that we're really gaining from this openness. And I think that the need for that is becoming more and more felt by people in the corporation, and so I feel that we are moving in the right direction in that way. That didn't really answer your question. Your question was about how do the two communicate. I think the answer is that we try very hard to provide tools that enable everyone in the project to communicate with each other and try and make it easy to communicate openly. Because if it's just as easy to communicate openly, people are more likely to do it. If it takes effort to kind of have the discussion in a way that is inclusive, then it's much easier to default to, oh, I really cannot be bothered to do that right now. I'm just going to call Bill and I'm going to chat through with him and we'll sort something out, you know. And, I mean, having hired a lot of people from the community, one hopes that they don't forget, you know what I mean? When they were on the outside and they were thinking that things weren't too transparent, you hope that once they get on the inside, they remember that. And I think for a little while that's true, although I think that, you know, if people have been on the inside for a while, they forget it after a bit. You have to keep reminding them.
What do you think the popularity of Firefox, or why do you think that Mozilla, in particular Mozilla Firefox, has been able to attract such a large number of users? I mean, you touched about it a little bit, but like, what specifically?
Right place at the right time, I think, probably. People were hurting. You know, the IE hadn't been updated since 2001. People were using the web in different ways. They were using it in more ways. The people, unscrupulous people, had been figuring out how to attack people with, you know, not just exploits and sort of ActiveX stuff, but with pop-ups and with, you know, all that sort of thing. And people, you know, people were trying to manage their information, you know, with a tool that was not suited for the task. And then along comes Firefox and starts innovating, and you know, there's some stuff that we, you know, picked up from other people. I mean, and you know, made famous in a sense, like tabs. We didn't invent tabs, and people often accuse us of claiming that we did, but we don't say that. But you know, we did popularize them. I think, you know, with 150 million users or however many it is now, or 150 million downloads anyway. And we sort of rolled it all together, and we did something that I think was important. It was a drop-in replacement for IE. You install it, it migrates your data, you know, sets itself up as the default if you ask it, and then you just keep going. And you can use it exactly the same as you used to use it, but as you discover the new features, you can start using them. There isn't a big cognitive gap. And I think that sort of, you know, replace it with something incrementally better, I mean, revolutionarily better in some ways, but it's a replacement rather than a sort of a big new way of doing things, I think was part of the key to success. I think also we benefited from having a cool name and a cool logo and a lot of buzz, which was self-feeding. When Firefox was cool, people come along and they tell their friends and it becomes more cool, and you know, you got a virtuous circle going there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was, but I mean, I think people cursed IE but didn't know what to do about it, and so we kind of rode that wave a little bit. And now of course IE7 is coming, and basically it seems to me that while they've innovated in a couple of areas, basically what this release is a catch-up release. And in a sense, that might be enough for them. It could be, you know, I'm using Firefox, but, you know, IE's now just about as good, has most of the features, I'll switch back. You know, the next release might be even better, and, you know, we have to carry on innovating. And that's good, because, you know, in a sense, the reason we started is because people weren't innovating. And so we don't have any right to rest on our laurels and say, you know, we're going to stop now. We've done something cool. Hey, just go away and use it. You know, we have to keep doing good stuff, and the things that we're doing for Firefox 2, like Places, which is sorting out the long overdue mess that is bookmarks and history, I think is a case in point. Back in 1996, when Netscape invented bookmarks, you know, technical people are just like, yeah, I'm going to file this bookmark now. I'm going to file it in, you know, under shops, and then under, you know, clothing, and I'm going to put it in there, and next time I want to buy some clothing, I'll go to shops, clothing, and pick out it out. And, you know, people may have worked that way, they don't work that way now. You know, it's like, you know, I want you to remember this stuff, sort it out, you know. I want you to fill in my forms, I want you to remember my passwords, I want you to do all of that, and I want it to just work for me. And it's the same with, you know, bookmarks and history and all the places you've been. I want to, like, you know, type in something that there's a reminder of where I've been, and I want you to give me some ideas. I want you to tell me where you think it is that I mean. You know, do what I mean, not what I say. And I'm hoping that some of the stuff we're doing with Places for Firefox 2 and more for Firefox 3 We'll sort that problem out. I think that's really quite exciting.
Mm-hmm.
What do you? I mean, this may be a difficult question, but what do you think made Firefox cool? What?
For users, right? Like.
Oh yeah, Jervis Markham, ultimate arbiter, cool. Yeah, like I can tell.
Another way to put it might be to say, why do people buy Firefox T-shirts?
You know, I find it difficult, right, to get on top of the concept of brand, because I'm a fairly straightforward person, and you know, if I need a shirt, I'll buy a shirt. I don't care what's written on it. Whereas there are some people who are like, I must have the Nike trainers, you know, I must have the Gap jeans. Now, part of me says that is because people get their sense of self-worth from the clothes that they wear. Now, I'm a Christian. I get my sense of self-worth from the fact that I'm a child of God and that I'm known and loved by Him. And that's wonderful. And so things like whether I'm wearing Nike trainers really don't matter to me. But there are people who don't have that. And maybe, you know, they get their self-worth from what their friends think of them, or whether they're wearing the right clothes, or whether they're in with the in crowd. And so I can only draw analogies. Maybe Firefox has become like, you know, Nike, or why do you drink Coke? I mean, why do you drink Coke rather than Pepsi? Well, do people care these days? So actually, it's a question that I feel very unqualified to answer, because I don't think in the way that people think who care about brand.
How would you maybe compare Mozilla's vision in 1998 with the present reality?
Vision. What vision did we have in 1998? I think in 1998, well, I wasn't around in 98, right? I arrived in 2000. But I think the vision over the first few years was just to ship something. I mean, I don't know how much you know about the history. They shipped it in 1998, and they worked on it for a few months, and then they decided, the decision was taken, basically by Netscape, to throw away the Netscape 4 rendering engine and replace it with Gecko, which was the new one, which had been written by some guys, and they were like, yeah, you know, in 6 months we can have a product built based on this, and it took 4 years. And a rendering engine is hard. You know, it has to cope with absolutely anything that anyone has decided to write out there on the web, and there are billions of web pages. And, you know, you have to do roughly what the person thought that would happen, you know, bug for bug compatible. And they're hard things to do. And, you know, I don't know whether management didn't realise that, or, you know, I'm sure there are other people among the project who were around at the time who can tell you much more, maybe Brendan and and people like that. I mean, it'd actually be interesting to hear from the people who actually wrote it who supported the change, because, you know, everyone you talk to now who's still with the project said, at the time, we thought it was the wrong thing to do. But they made that change, and so the key focus, at least when I arrived in 2000, was shipping something. We want to get something out the door that, you know, actually uses our technology. We don't want to be the project that never ships. We don't want to be stuck in perpetual beta. And in fact, that desire was so strong, both on the part of, I think, people in the project and the part of Netscape, who'd like done Netscape 4, right, at the same time as IE4. Then IE5 came out, and it was better, you know. It was, and then IE5.5 was better still, and they had no answer. And then, you know, I can't remember which came out, IE6 or Netscape 6, but, you know, it was a fairly close run thing. Maybe Netscape 6 was first. But, you know, they wanted to ship something built on their new stuff. And Netscape 6 was a dog. It sucked. Things weren't ready. They made some, you know, I was around at the ship time. That was when I was doing my internship. And so I kind of got a little bit of insight into the process from inside Netscape. And the, you know, the decisions they were making, it was like, for example, this is a tiny thing, but maybe it's a good example. You know when you have a window and you maximize it? What happens to the edges is they kind of move just off the screen. So if your cursor goes to the edge, you can't accidentally resize the window and stuff like that, right? It basically just occupies the whole thing, right? The new toolkit that they designed couldn't do that. When you maximized it, the edges just went to the edge. If you went to the edge to try to hit the scroll bar and you missed, you would, like, drag the window edge in. And that was incredibly irritating. You know, it can't maximize windows properly, right? How much does that suck? I mean, small thing, but I'm a usability guy at this kind of stuff, so it sticks in my head. And they shipped it. And it's like, look, we have not got time to fix this. You know, there's a patch. It's too risky, too destabilizing. We're going to fix it. And, you know, on the one hand, you know, if they want to hit a ship date, then you have to make those decisions. On the other hand, the product bombed in the marketplace. It sucked. No one liked it. They did a few updates. Didn't really improve matters. Netscape 7 was better. It was still, you know, sold out to commercial interests, and that's why no one really uses Netscape anymore. That's kind of the overarching reason. But people didn't use Netscape 6 for two reasons. It was sold out to commercial interests, and it sucked. So, yeah, I mean, the aim back in 98, 2000 was, let's ship something. We want to produce something good, and once we've done something good, then we can move on and do something better. The aim, you know, the aim today is, you know, ship some more. We've shipped. We shipped Mozilla 1. We shipped, you know, Netscape 7. They shipped it. We shipped Mozilla 1.4, which was the next long-lived branch. We shipped Firefox 1.0. We shipped Firefox 1.5. Let's ship and ship again. You know, we've got the taste for it. You know, so I think, you know, over the next 6 months, the aim is to produce something that will compete with what other people are doing. And I don't think, you know, it's embarrassing to say that. You know, that we want to innovate, we want to make life better for our users. And we want to make life so much better for our users that people want to use our product. Why not?
I've got a question. Why do you think people volunteer for Mozilla? What do you think their motivations are?
We just had a discussion about this, actually, in a breakout session. We had a whole thing about recruiting new people, and we discussed how some of us had come to the project. I mean, from my point of view, I volunteered because I wanted to get involved in writing some... Because, you know, you do a course at university, and there's a bit of software writing, but you want to get involved in something bigger. You know, you want to get involved in something that's actually producing stuff. Something that actually means something. And that original comment that I read was like, look, you know, if Mozilla doesn't succeed, then IE owns the web. And if IE owns the web, then Microsoft gets to say what happens on it, and that's good for nobody but Microsoft. And that's still true today. You know, that's why we have support from so many companies. It's because people realize that having one company owning the web is a really, really bad thing. And that's true of most ideas. You know, a level playing field produces the best games. So, I mean, I got involved. Sort of, there was that idealistic thing, and then when I actually arrived at the website and I wanted something to do, there was stuff for me to do. You know, it was like, there's this competition, and, you know, you make these test cases and you reduce them. Did I talk about that, or was that in the session? I think, yeah, there was a thing called the bugathon, where you, yeah, I did talk about that a bit. And, you know, and it was like I had stuff to do, and I just started doing it, and I enjoyed it, and the people were nice, and I had fun, and it was, you know, it was a community feel, and I just got in with it. And I think there are people who, I mean, again, we were discussing this. It's about people self-select a little bit for tenaciousness. You know what I mean? If you turn up and go, hey, how can I help? You know, give me something to do. People feel that, you know, the perception is among current contributors that people like that tend not to last. It's people who sort of turn up and just dive in and say, hey, I did this, is it useful? Or, hey, this needed doing, so I did it, here you go. The people who tend to stick around more. I mean, in one sense, you could say that's kind of bad because you're excluding a bunch of people from contributing, and if it were great to find ways to get the other people roped in, that's great. But on the other hand, you know, the reality of it is that maybe in a project this size, people are going to have to be a little bit, you know, self-managing, self-directing, because it's never going to be like a company where, you know, you are assigned to teach this person and you will give them 1.5 days a week of your time and you will, you know, give them things to do and you will hold their hand until they can, you know, it's just not going to happen. This person has all the things that they need to do and more, and they don't have much time for you. And that's not a reflection on your value, it's just a reflection on their busyness. So, yeah. But why do people get involved? Was the original question. I think probably because it's fun. I mean, it's got to be fun, hasn't it? No one is going to do something in their spare time if it's not fun. I mean, there's fun and there's fun, right? When you're, if you're a football player, a soccer player, you know, you train and, you know, you're out there in the wet and the mud and you're tramping around and you're thinking this is pretty miserable, but you do it because, you know, you then go out and play the games and you win the games, right? In the same way, people will volunteer and do stuff that sucks if they can see that, you know, it's not universally sucking and that it will continue through to being able to do something cool or to have some cool effect or to produce some cool bit of software. And so it doesn't all have to be fun, but it kind of has to be aggregate fun. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Now, back when Netscape originally released, they made you could say it's a strategic error, there were reasons for it, maybe not worth going into, but it was, you could not just take the code they released, download it, build it, have a browser, make some changes, build it again, and have a browser with your changes, right? You couldn't do that. It was very hard to build, or almost unbuildable, in fact, in its released form when you started. It was really tough. And that had a seriously deleterious effect on uptake upon volunteers, yeah? Because if you can't get that feedback of seeing your changes, then it's very hard to motivate people. And I think in the beginning, that was something that we really suffered from, although not today. And a lot of other projects have learnt from our experience. I mean, there are loads of lessons that people know about how to do open source right that I think were first learnt by us. You know, things like, you've got to start with working code, right? You know, if you want to do a project, if you just say, hey, we're going to do a project to X, you'll end up with 20 people on a mailing list and 3 guys designing the icon. Right. If you say, we want something to do X, and here's why, it doesn't do X, but, you know, it does something. Here it's in the CVS repository, send patches. You know, here's a list of things we might like it to do. You know, then you'll get much further. Because people will say, hey, that doesn't meet my needs, but it could. I can see it could, you know. And I can make these changes, and it's a bit closer. And that I think that motivates people.
Do you consider open source software work as providing a public service? Have you ever thought about it in that way?
I'm wondering how loaded you think the words public service are, because there's, like, you know, there's public service television, right? I think it provides one of the reasons that I think open source and free software are great. I mean, free software particularly, the ideology rather than open source, the business method. I mean, I'm not, do I need to go into the difference?
No.
Right, okay. Right, I think that there are, you know, people in not ridiculously poor countries, but fairly poor countries, right, who, I think it's great that, you know, if I write code, they can have it and they can use it and they can do stuff with it that makes their lives better, right? And I don't have to, I can do that for one person or a million people for the same effort. And that's basically only true of software. It's something that is functional, like a machine, yet has the reproduction characteristics of information, right? It's functional information. And so software is kind of unique in that sense. And so building software is really great because you can give it to those people. And I love that. I think that's fantastic. So in that sense, yes, it does provide a public service. I think it's really important. Yeah.
Do you see any other examples of open source production kind of in the culture more generally, outside of software? Can you see these kinds of business practices, these kinds of modes of working in other areas of cultural production?
The principles which apply to building free software, I think, probably translate best to knowledge production rather than production of physical objects, goods, or services, or physical objects or goods, right? So it makes sense to have an open source car design. It doesn't make much sense to have an open source project to build a car, right? You don't want to say, okay, guys, you know, meet up at, you know, the back parking lot on Friday night and bring any bits of metal that you've got and, you know, we'll see where we get, right? Not going to work so well, right? But if you have a website that says, look, we're gonna design a car that's, you know, really easy to build and suitable for production in, you know, in environments where people wouldn't otherwise have one, you know, we're going to do this, that, the other. Maybe a car's a bad example. You know, people have done... there's a place called ThinkCycle, which does, in a sense, collaborative development of solutions to the third world, water filters, plows, that sort of stuff. And, you know, that sort of collaborative open thinking where it's not encumbered by, you know, people going, oh, I have a patent on this, or, oh, this is my super secret idea and I'm going to exploit it, where people are working together for, you know, the common good. You can see those ideas applying. But, I guess things like that, maybe, you know, open source, in quotes, books, open source, you know, conglomeration of knowledge, Wikipedia, that sort of thing. I mean, you can see all of those things happening, anything where knowledge is required. And I think that, you know, anyone whose business model is purely selling knowledge needs to be reasonably concerned, because, you know, eventually their business is going to get eaten and they're going to have to do something different. I mean, you can sell assurance, right? Britannica could make a business model by saying that, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to take our stuff and Wikipedia stuff, put it together, we get this encyclopedia, but what you get when you buy our encyclopedia is that every single page has been fact-checked, right? As opposed to Wikipedia, where you just get what you get. And then you have people who go, okay, I don't mind, I don't care too much, I want to read about King James II, I'm just going to go and read the Wikipedia article, and then you've got people, I'm doing research, I need better stuff. Yeah, so you can use sort of this model of assurance. But if you just say, here's Britannica, a big disclaimer in the front, you know, we don't say any of this is accurate, but hey, it's just another source, right? Then, you know, I'm not convinced that business model is going to survive. So yeah, I can see the sort of collaborative development principles working in other areas, but mostly in the production of things that are intangible. They fit best there.
And so what do you think the popularity of Firefox now will do for sort of the future of open source, either for just for software or for the larger open source idea?
Well, what it'll do for the future of open source and what it'll do for the future of free software are actually two different things. Because open source is like, hey, this method of production produces better software, let's do that, right? And if it doesn't produce better software, the corollary is, well, maybe we shouldn't use it. And there are people who believe that. And in terms of that, it's not particularly revolutionary at all. It just happens to be one of those cases where doing it that way produces better software. And, you know, if IE8 is better, then, you know, people will go back. Now, in terms of its effect on the future of free software, the ideology that, you know, doing software collaboratively in this way is something that people should have, it, you know, a right to modify your software is like, you know, your right to walk down the street unmolested and your right to privacy in your home, then maybe not as much as it should, because Firefox is sold as an open source project and not a free software project. Yeah? When people get Firefox, they get the freedom, if you see what I mean, but they don't know they've got it, right? There's no, and I'm not sure how you would even do this, but there's no real attempt to say, okay, you've got this, it's cool, but it's also different, and here's why, and this is why it's important to you, yeah? And I think that's a little bit sad. I think that there's an opportunity that's missed there. I'm not quite sure what you would do about it and how you would go about making a change that improved that situation, but... You know, the fact that things like Firefox and OpenOffice are taking off is an opportunity for people, you know, if that's something that you believe, to tell people why software freedom is important. And it's not one that we're currently taking. And that could be because the Mozilla project, in general, generalising, is not necessarily made up with people who care about software freedom so much. Perhaps that's due to our history, the fact that we have a reasonably commercial friendly or a reasonably proprietary software friendly license in the MPL. You know, you can add proprietary stuff on. That's what Netscape wanted to do, and they did with Netscape 7, so that's why the license works that way. Whereas other free software projects have, you know, basically you have to give it all back type license, and those projects maybe attract a crowd who are more keen on the whole idea of software freedom as a right. Yeah, I mean, maybe that's part of the reason why the project doesn't push it so much, is because there's not a real sort of strong impetus among the contributors that's something that we need to be telling people about. Who knows?
And where do you see last question, the sort of moving forward, where do you see the Mozilla Foundation, the Mozilla Corporation going, you know, as we move ahead?
Well, the Mozilla Foundation itself is hoping to, you know, do some good with the product of our success, and we hope to make grants both within the Mozilla community, the free software community, and to a very small extent wider than that, to try and encourage, you know, fill in the gaps and encourage things to happen that aren't otherwise happening that we see as strategic and important. And so that hopefully is a big part of the future. It's the first time that a free software project has made a bunch of money which goes to the project and not to some sort of corporate entity that sponsors it and ends up in the hands of the shareholders. And so in a very sort of general sense, the community can look at that and go and say, wow, this is our money, rather than, you know, IBM's money or Sun's money. And so, you know, we need to figure out what we're going to do with it. And we're in the middle of doing that, and that's something that's quite exciting. In terms of the products themselves, you know, I'm very confident that we have a bunch of smart people who will continue to innovate in the space of making people's lives better, both in terms of the browser and, I hope, in terms of the email client, although exactly how much emphasis is put on that as opposed to Firefox is currently a matter of some discussion. But I personally think, you know, a decent alternative to Outlook and Outlook Express is very important, because both of them are bug-riddled and horribly insecure. And we need to make people's lives better there too. But, you know, on the other hand, the single-minded focus, which has put Firefox at the front, was a single-minded focus, and, you know, you can't concentrate your resources across the board, can you? So, yeah, I mean, the products are going to keep getting better. If we, you know, I mean, world domination will be nice, but as long as we keep sufficient market share that the web remains open, I think that's the best thing that we can do for the world at large. Because if, you know, the guy who was born yesterday in India grows up and wants to use the web, and he can use it on his one laptop per child laptop with his free software browser, rather than going, hey, half of this doesn't work because it's all written in, you know, Microsoft new Vista specific, you know, spiffy what's it doodah, then, you know, I think that's that comes back to the core mission of the foundation, which is to promote choice and innovation on the internet. Firefox is our big lever, our big stick for keeping the internet open, and I think that's the key thing. And if that continues to happen and stay that way, then I think we're a success.
Great. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks.